We're going to be talking today about walk this way, and that implies that there is a way. It implies there's a way. That's quite a controversial thing to actually say. I think a little bit more of us would be more confident in a headline that said, find the way. Find the way. That's generally the story that we live in today. When you, I was for many years at the University of Cape Town lecturing, and I would see it happening. The students would come, and they would pretty much be told, find your way at Varsity. And of course, in first year, what was the way? It was parties. It was the good life. And that was the story you lived in, to just able to finally get out of that all-boys school or all-girls school. And you were like, woo! And then after first year, what did you notice? You'd put on a lot of weight. First year spread is real. And so suddenly the second year story is health, wellness, gym. And you do the whole health thing for a year. And then you start hearing about it, something called the job, and you need to get interviewed. And you suddenly realize, whoa, my marks are not going to get me that interview. And so the new story you live into is study. Out come the glasses. You're in the library. You're in bed early. And so you live your life in these different stories. And university is like an accelerated part of that. But actually, if you look at the big sweep of life, we're all living in stories. Now I'm building towards my career. Now I'm building to provide for my family. Oh, you know, this job thing, I probably should do a little bit more for the community. And then in later life, hey, I should think about the next generations and the sustainability of the planet. And these big themes kind of sweep over our lives. But the overall one, if you listen to graduation ceremonies or commencement addresses in America, if you YouTube or Google these things, famous people will come and stand and they'll say they're pretty much the same thing. Find your passion. Follow your passion. Do your thing. You do you. But what we see here as a distinction in the Christian faith is that, no, there is a way. There is a story. And perhaps we're not as free to choose as we might imagine. And I want to put up a quote here, which kind of gets a little bit meta. That's why I want it to be put up here. But it's by a theologian, Stanley Hauerwas, who wants us to realize that this story, that it's up to us to find our stories, is just that. It's another story. Follow with me as he explains. He says, the lie is exposed by simply asking, who told you the story that you should have no story except the story you choose when you have no story? Do you follow that? Everyone's kind of saying to you right now, hey, there are all these stories, but you should ignore all of them, and then you should decide which story best fits for you and live that out. Of course, what he's pointing out is, well, that's a story itself. And who's to say that should be your story? That's why he calls it a lie. He says, why should you let that story determine your life? Simply put, the story of freedom has now become our fate, or the default setting in which we live. But is it really the right story? See, there's a big difference between finding your way, or finding your why, or finding your story, and knowing the way, knowing your why, knowing something. And at the conference on Friday, we were reminded of these four words, which really change everything. That's how the Bible starts. It starts with this: in the beginning, God. In the beginning, God. That's a game changer sentence. Either that's true or it's not. And if you're investigating it, you'd really want to explore it. But you'd know that the whole thing changes on those four words. In the beginning, God. Because if there is a God, then there is a way. There is a God who's designed this world that we live in, who's created it, and who has, with our best in mind, a direction, a path for us to live into. Last week we said there's a map, there's an owner's manual, there is a way. And let's continue to explore this way this week. We're going to read the whole passage again. And the major theme of last week, remember, was to put off your old self. I'm going to read it again. But the major theme was put off your old self and put on the new self. Notice the language difference. Put off your old self, all that journey trying to find a story, and put on the new self, the one that's been created by God for you. And I'm kind of nervous that we might have heard last week and think, okay, there are two paths, there are two lives. Do I like the old one or the new one? And I'm kind of weighing it up. But fundamentally, these are two completely different paths. And on Friday, there was an amazing reference to the watermelon seed, which I really enjoyed. And I'm sharing it with you at the beginning to make sure that we don't fall into this trap. You see, if you looked at a watermelon seed and you sat down with a child and you said, here's a watermelon seed, you won't believe what this grows into. It's a little, tiny little seed. We know what they are because we have about 7 in every mouthful of watermelon. Mm-hmm. You won't believe what happens to this little seed. This little seed becomes this monster green watermelon. You cut it up and you will find a million other little seeds inside there. It's this one little seed has a million other little seeds inside of it, but it also has this juicy pink. I mean, it's amazing. You can put it in a fridge and it's cool. And it's, I mean, the kid will look at you and go, sure, bud, sure, right? There's just no way that little seed creates that massive thing. In the same way, when we're told to put off the old self, we're getting told to put off the little pip, put off that little seed. And we're getting told to put on the new self. We're getting told to put on the watermelon, to put on that which God's placed inside of you, which only with His Spirit at work in you comes into fruition, comes into what God has ultimately put in you to be. So when we say put off the old self, put on the new self, we're not saying change one pip life into another pip life, like, hey, pip living, right? We say, no, there's a whole new life. There's a whole new life, which on this side, you're not, it's not going to make sense. In many ways, it's miraculous. You're going to find yourself looking back and go, how did I end up here? How am I doing this life? It's completely different. Well, that's what happens when the life of God is at work in us. Okay, so with that analogy in mind, let's read chapter 5, verse 17, written to the people of Ephesus, but also to us today to apply to our lives. Let's read from verse 17. Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They're darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. They've become callous, they've given themselves up to sensuality, greedy to practice every kind of impurity. But that's not the way you learned Christ, assuming that you have heard about Him and were taught in Him, as the truth is in Jesus. To put off your old self, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and to put on the new self, created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. Now here come our three verses for tonight. Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. And I'm going to read on to the end. Kyle will talk about this next week, but just to get the flow of the argument, let's just take it to the end. It says, let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ forgave you. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Thanks be to God for his word to us tonight. There are kind of three clear sections in the passage that I'm going to get to look at. It's quite clear what the old self is, what the new self is, and the kind of rhythm of the time is to say, well, what's the point? What did it mean to them then? What does it mean to us now? And we'll kind of make our way through the passage. So the first point, let's start at verse 25, is this simple one of to speak the truth. This is something we need to put on in our lives as a community. It's to speak the truth. Let's unpack it from verse 25. It says, therefore. So he's connecting it to the teachings that have gone on before. He said, hey, all that stuff about the old self and putting on the new self, I'm now going to get practical with you. That's what we're going to look at for the next 2 weeks. Let's get practical about what this would actually look like to give up the pip living for the watermelon. What would it start to look like? Well, part of it would be to put away falsehood, to put off that old self. This wouldn't have been anything new. In fact, the Ten Commandments, commandment number 9, you must not give false evidence against your neighbor. You must not give false evidence against your neighbor. This wouldn't have been anything new. But if they're anything like us, they would have struggled to actually implement this in their lives. They would have actually struggled to put this practice off. They would have maybe shaded the truth to suit their needs. And in a post-truth alternative facts life that we now live, I think we can all identify with this. I want to spend a little bit of time on this because sometimes we just forget the foolishness of sin and we forget the foolishness of taking this wrong path. We think actually we're going to get away with it. And I was reminded in the morning in preparation of, went to an all-boys school and you know those projects that you're supposed to work on for months and then you leave it way too late. And my one mate decided this is bad and he got his mom involved. And his mom wrote his poetry and his essays and everything. The only problem was his mom did brilliantly. I mean, we are talking emotional, just beautiful. He was a South African surfer, and so this was incredible. You had this boy, but like hardcore surfer, but now he's just so obviously in touch with his emotions. So much so that they actually gave a special award to him at our prize giving for the outstanding job he did. What made it even worse was his mom was there standing up like, yay! And everyone was like, but you wrote it. The teachers didn't know it. His English marks weren't that good, but based on this project, he got promoted straight into the ad English class and was kind of said, no, you belong here. He didn't belong there. He struggled to read the words. The teachers were saying, stop messing around, read properly. But he was like, I can't read what's getting said here. Eventually, I remember in the one class, I said, man, my eyes are sunburnt from all the sun and surfing. It got so bad. The guy said one lie, but it just ran out. And that's like kind of a humorous example. But how many of us have found ourselves thinking, oh, it's just a small thing. And then we have to remember it for the rest of our lives. So the incredible thing about telling the truth is you don't have to remember anything. As soon as you lie, you've got to remember everything. What did I say, so-and-so? And it traps us. It's a poor foundation for living. It's a snowball that keeps rolling down and it causes all kinds of anxiety. It's been told us, put that away. Rather, do something else. The ninth commandment is upgraded. It's not just a case of not doing something. We're told we need to speak the truth with his neighbor. It's a case of saying, you know, you've learned Christ. You've seen God's goodness towards you. Like he's patient, you should be patient. Slow to anger, you should be slow to anger. And you shouldn't just kind of be wanting to go in there and drop the truth bomb and storm out. No, you want to speak truth in love. That came earlier as we've been studying this passage and this book together. The reason's given as well. The reason is, for we are members of one body. We're knitting together social fabric here. We're not individuals on our own mission. No, we're coming together as a group, unified in our diversity, growing in knowledge of God as we follow him together. And this reason is so important, that what kind of person would want to damage their own body by spreading the virus of untruth? It's hard to make good decisions if you're fed bad information, right? It's hard to know what's right and wrong when you're fed bad information. Now, that's bad enough if that information comes from the outside, but imagine if someone inside telling you the wrong thing. John Stott, the theologian, said it's the equivalent of stabbing yourself when you start spreading lies around the body of Christ. Now, they would have heard all of this, but like, much like us, they would have maybe just struggled with, well, how do we practically do that? How do we put away falsehood? How do we speak the truth in love? How do we take this commandment not to give false evidence to the next level? Well, we find the same thing today, right? We struggle also to put away falsehood. There's not a person in this room who doesn't struggle with this. If I examine my own life, it's quite interesting, quite telling, those moments when you can easily just find yourself lying but not even identifying it. I remember you're in a meeting with someone. Yeah, no, I'll do that. Yeah, great. Completely forget about it. A week later, they pop into your office. They go, hey, Paul, where are we at on that document you were putting together? Are we done? Just straight looking at them. Almost done. I mean, I don't even think, do I cross the boundary now? Do I enter into falsehood? No. What happened in that moment is I have a view of myself. I am disciplined. I'm organized. I don't let balls drop. I'm an achiever. Suddenly, I'm confronted with the fact I have dropped a ball. I haven't achieved. I am clearly ill-disciplined in this regard. And I can either own that, put on truth and speak truth to that person, or I can just fake it till I make it and hustle back to the computer and try and whack out a document in the next few hours, desperately trying to look like it wasn't just put together. This is complex stuff, but it actually gets at the heart to say, none of us start the day going to put on falsehood. But what we do put on the day is we say, I'm going to maintain my identity as an organized person. I'm going to maintain my pursuit for wealth, regardless of the consequences that it might have for others. I'm gonna make sure this person thinks well of me no matter what it takes. So it's not that we turn our back on truth. We just value something else more important than who God's made us to be and the identity he's shaped around us. And so we need to dig deeper. When you find yourself in a moment of line, don't waste that moment. Bring it before God and say, God, what in that moment was more important to me than you and your opinion of me? What was it? And I've thought about it as a communal level, and if we all do that, we can start to close the gap between the line and then running to God, and line and running to God, and say, God, help me to deal with this issue at the root so that I can get to loving and not spreading the virus of untruth around this community. But I've also been reflecting a lot on how the stories we tell ourselves in community are also against the backdrop of the stories we hear about ourselves in our nation and in the media. My sister's very involved in the media. I'm not taking a swipe if you're involved. But we have seen a massive shift in the last 10 to 20 years as the business model for media is effectively broken. Media and newspaper used to be made out of classified section. You know, like, I'm selling my bicycle. I've got a pet. Please, can you buy it? And some of you don't even know about the classified section, but it was this thick section that came in the newspaper, and they charged R1 a word, and it was where they made their money. The classified section in South Africa got ripped out of the newspaper and pretty much put on Gumtree. And suddenly the business model collapsed. They thought, oh, we'll make it all free and we'll get clicks on adverts. The problem is they don't get nearly as many clicks as they used to get money from classifieds. So the business model is essentially failing. What do you do in a circumstance? And cultural commentator and pastor from from Australia, Mark says, I wanted to hide the fact that he was Australian, obviously. I think at root, that was what underlying sin was. But here we go. Here's what he says. He says, the move, I'll read it all the way through and then I'll comment when I get back. The move from a broadcast and print-based subscription model of news to one in which endless blogs and online news sources need a constant river of new content signals a switch from a reflective editorial model rooted in discovering and reporting the truth to a reactive content hunting model which seeks an emotional response. The financial incentives are no longer found in delivering accurate reporting, but in gaining clicks. Thus, a highly emotive, reactive media landscape is created in which the money is to be made in creating emotive content, which bypasses our faculties of reason and activates our limbic system. This creates a never-ending stream of content which centers around concepts of pleasure, shame, controversy, tribalism, hate, disgust, sex, curiosity, and identity affirmation. So go back to the beginning of the quote. Effectively, he's saying you used to give balanced, middle-of-the-road arguments. People would say that's the best source of news. They would read you and they'd give their classified section advert. Now, we go online and they can track exactly what we click on. What do we click on? Do we click on the long-form, deeply researched, complex, argued article that at the end says, it depends, because life is complex? Or do we click on the one that gives us a quick confidence boost? This person said this, that person said that, and we can dive down a rabbit hole depending on which side we want to support and which view echoes back to us what we already believe. The clicks don't lie. The media owners are looking in going, we don't like what's happening, but the only business model that works is a business model where clicks are generated, and what seems to generate clicks is what's described there as an emotional response, and on the next page is speaking about a limbic response, that fight or flight that essentially triggers our brains and gets us incredibly emotional, that pushes us into camps where we want controversy, shame, tribalism, hate, disgust. So this is what's happening, and if you've ever kind of thought, I'll just go and check the news for 5 minutes, and you come out 30 minutes later feeling like you need to have a shower, you know a little bit about what it feels like almost to be a full-time South African. It feels like it's a job to keep up with all the emotions that are triggered online, all the commissions of inquiry, all the news that we get about each other, but all filtered through a very polarizing lens. And you've been given this God-given desire for justice, so be too triggered is right. But the problem is, we're often triggered about a whole bunch of stuff that we can actually do very little about. I find myself shocked how much I'm reading about an election happening in North America, not even this year, that I'm not even allowed to vote in. And yet, there are neighbors, there are people in this room who I could spend time with to get to know and find out their story and their background, and I'd actually be able to, on an ongoing basis, connect with them and take action in their lives and love them and be community with them. I'm giving you permission tonight to not click, to pause, reflect, and say, could I rather connect with someone in a physical way and actually build relationship with people that I can live life with? One of my little habits, maybe not everyone can do this, but I get hold of some magazines from a buddy who subscribes, The Economist, and I read them superbly out of date, like 6 weeks later. And they're worried about some big crisis, Brexit. I'm like, didn't happen, keep going. This is beautiful, consuming media without all the angst of it. I know for some of your jobs that's not possible, but I've just delighted in finding about our other countries and what's happening in the world, but without the sense of doom and paranoia flooding me. So often, because we fill ourselves with all this news we can do so little about, we don't have time then to connect with each other, because quite frankly, we're so exhausted and emotionally charged, we don't even know how to do that. And so, can I invite you to speak the truth in love, but to speak truth about each other and our lives and get into each other's lives rather than being filled up to the brim by a broken business model that's trying to get itself to work, but hijacking our God-given desire for justice at the same time. Let's speak the truth. What's point number two? Be angry and do not sin. Be angry and do not sin. Be angry? I mean, some of you are going, what? What? Good news. Passion is allowed. Caring is good. The opposite of love is not hate. It's actually apathy. It's indifference. It's going, well, whatever. That's the opposite of love. And we've been told to walk in love, that coming next week in particular, but we'll look at it today. We've been told to walk in love. And it's because God's given us passions for justice and passion for other people that should translate into compassion. We should be caring for others, but he knows that this can go wrong. And that's why the commandment to us is be angry and do not sin. There's a disclaimer there saying, yeah, you need to be filled with passion, but make sure that's passion that leads to compassion, not passion that leads to sin, that leads to self-centeredness, that leads to pushing away others. Again, this is not something new. Commandment, the sixth one, said to us, you must not commit murder. And Jesus upgraded that and said, yeah, but where does murder start? Murder starts with contempt. It starts with that looking down your nose at other people saying, oh, these people, man, they're there. What's wrong with the world? So it's not just a call to put off sin and anger. It's a call to put on compassion with others. The analogy that's always made sense to me is if you're lucky enough in your life to have ever had a fireplace and you put some wood in there, wow, what a pleasure. Lovely place to sit down, have a glass of hot cocoa, maybe some grape juice. It's been aged. And you just enjoy yourself around that fireplace, right? That's a beautiful scene. The only problem is if that fire gets out of place and it gets on the carpet and the couch and starts burning the place down, suddenly that is not a happy scenario at all. Passion for life is a great thing. Passion displaced, put in the wrong place, taken down a self-centered route, can cause absolute havoc. That's what we see with this encouragement to be angry and not to sin. There's some very practical advice around this, and that is that we should not let the sun go down on your anger. You need to move towards things quickly. If you're anything like me, you have an altercation, you misunderstand each other, you both go away for a while, what do you do in your mind? You replay it, but when you replay it, the witty comments are just there. You're like, I should have said that. That would have been the one. And of course, what's the other person doing? The exact same thing. And now, as you've kind of worked on your delicious zinger comebacks, you're actually looking forward to the next time you meet because you're like, come on, go there. I got myself some lines now. I got myself some lines. And then you get back together and it's like, ba, ba, ba. And of course, they've got their lines. You're like, ooh, that was good. Damn, I got to work on my lines. And then off you go. And it just kind of keeps going back and forth. Every time you replay it, you puff yourself up and you belittle the other person. They do the same thing. That doesn't bring you together. That builds you further and further away. It's a very practical advice. It says, do not let the sun go down. Move towards them because you know, left to your own devices overnight, you are going to be daydreaming about all the ways in which you were right and they were wrong. Short circuit all of that. Quick example, I didn't tell this morning, but I remember as a linesman, I was injured at rugby and was first team and very hectic, you know, and this touring UK team. I was made the linesman because I was injured. And I stood under the pole and I said, okay, bro, you look at that pole, I'll look at this pole. And this kick literally goes over right over my pole. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I said to the ref, it went right over. I don't know if that's in or out, whatever. And the ref said, okay, it's over. This guy's like, no, it's not over. He had his flag down. Now, obviously, there's a moment like, no, my flag's up. That's your pole. That wasn't your pole. It was my pole. Like, which one is it? And I'm getting emotional. And then people are like, what does that guy do? And I realized I just ran across the field to this guy. I just ran to him. I said, hey, bro, just so you know, if you're standing there and you're looking, you can't actually see what's happening in the pole. That was my pole, right? And I know you're under pressure, but like, I'm not trying to cheat. That just went straight over. And it was amazing how quickly we could resolve. I said, sorry, yeah, I should have listened. And we kind of just had a little moment and went back. And it just calmed it all down. And the guy's like, whoa, what was that guy? I said, bro, we've talked it out. It's fine. But I know my natural inclination would have been to like, oh man, these British touring teams, they always cheat. You know, and you build this thing up in your mind. Why did I get that silly example? There are not a lot of examples, but that was the one time where I went, man, that just diffused the whole thing, just closing that gap quickly. And the sentence you can say is just, hey, help me understand. It's a humble posture. Help me understand what happened there. Did we misunderstand? Do not let the sun go down on your anger. And give no opportunity to the devil. Again, there's a reason here. What is this reason? Well, the devil loves to distort, loves to take what God's created and to unseat it. There's a myth that there's only a material world. But no, there is a non-material world which we are invited into. And part of what we understand that there is an opposition to God, which has been defeated, yes, but is still active in this world. And essentially that opposition tends us towards self-centeredness, points us toward a life apart from God, and will ask us questions like, did God really say? Is that really what God intends for you? And the danger in our life is that we think, no, 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 there's no such thing. You know, we've got to take personal responsibility for everything. That's the story I've been told. There's no story except the story you choose, and you need to take responsibility. But what tends to happen if you don't have a devil in your understanding is that you make other people the devil. You don't see them as flawed people like yourself, and you start to say things like, that's wrong with the world, and they're wrong with the world, and that polarization takes us further and further apart. In chapter 6 of Ephesians, there's a whole chapter on spiritual warfare, and we'll be looking at that in probably November, December, about what it means to fight this battle well. But for now, just to say, do not let the sun go down in anger. Give no opportunity to the devil. And ultimately, this comes down to our desires. If you spend a day and just reflect afterwards, say, when was I emotional? When was I angry? What are the type of things that make me angry? Well, that you're going to find out very valuable information about what actually is happening at the core of who you are. Why are you sad? You didn't get what you wanted. Why are you angry? Well, someone's threatening what you want. Why are you jealous? Someone else got what you wanted. Why are you happy? I got what I wanted. Why are you anxious? I might not get what I want. Past, present, future. Our desires tell us a lot about ultimately what's happening. Our emotions tell us a lot about ultimately what's happening underneath our hearts. There's a New Yorker article I read called The Decline of Yelling, which is about how we're not yelling as much in public. People are just like, don't do it. But we just take it all online. The guy writes an article, says, I tell my patients, he's a psychologist, that anger, like anxiety, can be a very important and useful emotion when harnessed correctly. Often we get to the most onerous, blistering, radical truth about something when we're angry. Find out what's actually inside of us. And how that works out in communal life is also important. How we do life together. That's connected. You see, if we're taking on falsehood and we're doing this full-time job of being a South African, we're getting triggered so emotionally. When we get into a space of being with each other, you know, often we're just like, oh man, I've got no capacity. I'm like just going to be apathetic. I don't want any more conflict here. It's not a global phenomenon. He's writing here, the author of this article, he says, oh, we've seen less frenetic stuff in the public square. Why? Because finding solace of the self is requiring a muted response these days. Imagine what younger people are up against in terms of finding their way. There's so much conflict out there that we don't want any more conflict. We don't want to be angry. We actually just prefer to just kind of be apathetic. But it does leak out in our personal relationships. And so I know there are not a lot of married people here, but I thought I'd let you guys know. So you prepare for marriage potentially, and you can apply this in key relationships with friends and certainly at workplace. Some research that might be helpful in terms of how we relate to each other in community and how we are angry but do not sin. So let's read it together. It should appear on the screens now. Ever catch yourself rolling your eyes at your partner or getting a little too sarcastic during a conversation? These seemingly small behaviors are not that innocent. After all, according to renowned researcher John Gottman, contemptuous behavior like eye rolling, sarcasm, and name calling is the number one predictor of divorce. For 40 years, the University of Washington psychology professor and his team at the Gottman Institute have studied couples' interactions to determine the four predictors of divorce, whereas Gottman calls them the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Contempt is the number one sign. So when Jesus told us to forget about not murdering, Don't even treat others with contempt. Don't even get angry with them. He knew what he was talking about. Followed by criticism, defensiveness, and stonewalling, which is emotionally withdrawing from your partner. As a man, I know stonewalling. Now, there's seven tips that are going to get put up here, thanks to the Huffington Post research, that I want you to have for completeness. Realize that delivery is everything. Ban the word whatever from your vocabulary. Stay clear of sarcasm, mean-spirited jokes. Don't live in the past. Watch your body language. Don't ever tell your spouse you're overreacting. And if you find yourself being contemptuous, stop and take a deep breath. Now, we can apply this in all our key relationships. Or at least I should say we can try and apply this in all our relationships. You're in the middle of the battle and you're like, oh, I landed that singer. Oh, wait, I feel I'm being contemptuous. Okay? Take a deep breath. It's not always easy. And if I've reflected on my own life, And this is why it's so important to, again, locate yourself in the story. Which story are you living in? Now, I've looked at the conflict and the snowballing, the really kind of ugliness of all that. I'd say 99% of the time, there's been one thing underneath it all. 99% of the time, it has been selfishness. It has been me wanting the other to orbit around my story and the way I see things, and an unwillingness to say, you know what, I've been made in the image of God who didn't come to be served, but came to serve. And if I've been made in his image, I'm actually going to be the most happy when it's not about me and it's about serving and loving others. But I lose sight of that story, and I'm about defending myself and getting my view across. Again, John Stott had this to say. He said, you know what, there's more than enough anger in the world. There's more than enough anger, but it's not Christian anger, because it's anger directed at getting the world to orbit around you. It's not anger directed at the injustice done to others, fight on behalf of others, to care for others. It's not an anger fueled by compassion for others. It's an anger fueled by self-centeredness and selfishness. So the encouragement here is to be angry, do not sin. How do you actually get that right? Well, fundamentally, you need your story to change, because if you're anything like me, your selfishness is going to make a list like that stay in your wallet or stay in your purse, but never actually get functionally put into your life. You're going to be a pup trying to live a watermelon life, but man, you're never going to get to actually any of that stuff, because at the core, you haven't changed your nature. You don't have God's Spirit alive and working in you. Final point tonight, it's our quickest one, is this encouragement to do honest work. Do honest work. It says there, let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor. Do honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone in need. Again, we've got a commandment here, the eighth commandment, you must not steal. They would have known about that particular comment, but the situation in Ephesus, as Paul goes around, is all kinds of people are getting to know about Jesus. People that had jobs, people that didn't have jobs. And most people in the town would have said, well, I don't know how they make it. They're probably stealing, but good luck to them, until such time as they're caught. And when they're caught, justice prevails. Justice takes its course, and you're thrown in jail. And very often in jail, you weren't fed. You had to rely on other people to bring you food. And often there would be no one to bring you food, and the consequences would be enormous. And what Paul's saying is, it's understandable. You've lived this life. You had to steal, but now that you're in Christ, that you've been united to him, you put off the old self. It might be understandable, but it's not allowable. And there's a reason why theft is not encouraged. Well, quite simply, it's a group of people go work, they materialize their work into something, and then another group just come along and steal it. Creates havoc in society where there's a shortcut to wealth, which is just to steal what others have done. Just think about the resources that then have to get spent on safety and security just to maintain what's actually been made, instead of actually being able to go out and create something else productive. South Africa's private security sector employs over 1 million people. Frightening statistic. They need to be there to do a job, but think about the productivity that could have been spent with all their hours of labor, instead of protecting what we've created, but actually creating something new. This is part of the tragedy and the foolishness of the sin that theft creates. And of course, for the thief themselves, they struggle to actually integrate into community, because deep down inside, they know that what they're doing is not something they can share openly with others. And so their capacity for relationship collapses. And so in loving kindness, God through his word says to us, rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands. Put on the new self. Work is before the fall. Genesis 1 and 2. Made in the image of God. We were created for work. And you'll notice that the word honest means that there's honest work and there's dishonest work. Honest work would have God at the center for human flourishing. Dishonest work would have us at the center using humans to make us flourish. There's a difference. And perhaps today you find yourself out of work or homeless or struggling in life. The encouragement to you is that your work is finding work. Your work is diving into community like this and struggling to get yourself out of those things that are holding you back, to see God at work within you. And the whole reason for this is not just so that you can get back to Operation You or You Inc. The whole point, again, is so that you may have something to share with anyone in need. Radical other-centeredness that we've seen come throughout this book. And they would have heard in their first century is, hey, we've all come from different places. No matter how you got here, stop stealing. Do honest work. Not for yourself, but so that you can share with others. Today, one of the tragedies about being told there's no story except the story you choose is that one of the big ways in which we choose our identity and the way we choose our story is we look at our careers. And we say, well, if it's up to me, one of the big markers would be what I do. So I better find something that is incredible. And that, quite frankly, can get exhausting and lead to all kinds of levels of burnout and stress, because no job can carry the weight of your identity and your purpose and your meaning. And part of what we need to recover today is this understanding that there's something called honest work. There's something God's prepared for us to do that's not about us, but about others and their flourishing. And so we can take some hits on what others think of us, but as long as we know what God thinks of us and how we're contributing towards others, to recover this sense of vocation and calling. Dorothy Sayers, who observed in World War II, a fascinating phenomenon. People were obviously in tragedy going around them, but yet found work deeply satisfying. I'll quote from her. She says, "The reason why men and women often find themselves happy and satisfied in the army is that for the first time in their lives, they found themselves doing something, not for the pay, which in the army is miserable, but for the sake of getting the thing done. There was purpose and meaning in what they were doing." Now, Sayers was talking about wartime Britain, in which every person knew that their work was contributing to the very survival of the nation. But author Lester DaCosta, his quote's going to pop up now, does an excellent job of showing us how indispensable work is for human life in all times and in all places. Imagine that everyone quits working right now. What happens? Civilized life quickly melts away. Food vanishes from the shelves. Gas or petrol dries up at the pumps. Streets are no longer patrolled and fires burn themselves up. Communication and transportation end. Utilities go dead. Those who survive at all are soon huddled around campfires, sleeping in caves, clothed in raw animal hides. The difference between wilderness and culture is simply work. Something God created for us before the fall to do. We've been given different gifts. We don't do it for ourselves. We do it to serve others. And so in conclusion this evening, in a world full of fake news that's trying to trigger us, and then full of an outrage culture that throws more fuel onto the flames, there's a temptation to kind of just be a commentator or a criticizer who stays out of all of it because it's overwhelming. But yet the word of God tonight says, no. You're called to engage with what's happening. You're called to put off the old self and put on the new self. You're called to speak the truth, as difficult as it might get and as clumsy as it might be. And as we offend each other, as we do that, let's not let the sun go down on anger. Let's keep meeting and keep gathering and keep finding out what it means to be angry and do not sin. What makes us angry? When we see others not living into what God has for them. It's our love for others that drives us to have these conversations, not a desire for conflict. And finally, we long to be contributors in this nation, to do honest work, to think about how our lives and our gifts can intersect with God's plan. I'd love to call the band up now. We're going to have an opportunity to respond, but I want to remind us about right at the end there, where God calls us to be imitators of God as beloved children, to walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Do you see the encouragement there to be imitators of God? That implies that God's done something that we're to imitate. And you'll notice that we're told, hey, do honest work, not for yourself, but so that you can have something to share with others. Well, who does that remind you of? Who does it remind you of? Someone who did something so that he could share that with others. I mean, that is who Jesus Christ is. He didn't come to be served. He came to serve. He came to do something which he's sharing, which each and every person alive, everyone made in the image of God, regardless of how you found yourself here tonight, regardless of the faith tradition you grew up with, all the questions you have about life, you've been told to find a way, and tonight I'm revealing the way, the truth, and life. Who Jesus Christ came, it's God to us, and said to us, I'm the way, the truth, and life, and he did something on the cross which he's made available to all. What did he do on the cross? He did work that none of us could do. He closed that gap between us and God. The rebellion we lived into, the story we've lived into has created huge distance between us and God, a gap none of us could close, but yet he came and closed that gap on our behalf. And he is the one who in resurrection power points us to the same power that he has at work in him is poured out into us. Will you stand with me? And as a time of response now, would we invite the Spirit of God to be at work in us? To take the little watermelon pips of our lives, as unimpressive as they are, and say, God, I'm placing it in your hands. I'm turning to you. I need to put off the old self and put on the new self. We're going to have a time of response with songs. I'm sure Kyle will lead us in different moments. But as I've been speaking tonight, God has been putting his finger on different things. Let the focus not be on you. Let it be on this good God who's made a way for us. So come, Holy Spirit. Come, God. As we respond to you, we worship you together.